Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. On today's show, we have an in-depth conversation with Marcus Miller. He has a career that spans from the 1970s through today. He's a multi-instrumentalist best known for his dynamic bass playing as a sideman for the likes of Brian Ferry, Roberta Flack, Luther Vandross, and jazz legend Miles Davis. He's produced and performed on countless records and picked up a few Grammys along the way. He'll be in High Point next weekend for the John Coltrane International Jazz and Blues Festival, and he's here today in conversation with David Ford. Then we head over to Sika for a Sugar Cane and Hurricane revival with singer-songwriter Beth McKee. Beth's music has been said to sit on the edge of the swamp and the city, and we'll have a sampler for you on the back end of the show. Jazz, blues, R&B, and regional charm on Triad Arts Weekend after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. The 5th annual John Coltrane International Jazz and Blues Festival kicks off in High Point on Friday, September 5th. Over the past 5 years, they've brought some of the top names in jazz and blues to Oak Hollow Park. The festival has also featured local, regional, and student musicians. This year, all the headliners are Grammy Award winners, like today's guest, Marcus Miller. Marcus Miller is a multi-instrumentalist whose musical legacy stretches over the past 4 decades. From his career-revitalizing work as a producer and instrumentalist for Aretha Franklin and Miles Davis, to his production history with R&B superstars Luther Vandross and Mariah Carey, Marcus has been the go-to guy for arrangements, studio polish, and inventive yet groove-driven bass. He collaborated with David Sanborn on stage and in studio, and released a string of solo recordings from the 90s to now. Peer into his catalog and you'll also find classical collaborations, such as 2008's A Night in Monte Carlo with the Monte Carlo Philharmonic Orchestra. His latest record is called Aphrodisia. It was recorded around the world, and was inspired by his role as a UNESCO Artist for Peace, a role that Marcus explains during his conversation with Triad Arts executive producer and admitted superfan, David Ford.
Marcus, I've been a huge fan of your music for more than 30 years now, and I remember, I guess I was a freshman in college, my grandfather was living in Massapequa at that time, and we'd go into the city and visit my uncle. And my brother Brian and I were visiting. We heard that you were living in Jamaica, Queens at that time.
Right.
And this is all pre-computer. And so we went out, we got a phone book, and we looked up every Marcus Miller in that area. There's more than one. And we're going on a list calling these people. Are you Marcus Miller? We want to hear you play.
And
anyway, so thank you for that little adventure.
You never spoke to me, right?
We never got in touch with the Marcus Miller, but we tried, by golly. You said that as a 10-year-old, after hearing the Jackson 5, you immediately knew that you wanted to be a musician. But before you first heard the Jackson 5, what kinds of sounds were you hearing at home, and what was your family dynamic like back then?
My dad's a piano player and an organist. Growing up in our apartment in Brooklyn and then later on in Queens, we heard him practicing. You know, he was practicing classical Bach, Beethoven, and then the hymns and the gospel music that we were performing at church. You know, it wasn't gospel as people know it now. It's more like, because it was an Episcopal church, so it was way more classical oriented. So hearing that, you know, when Dad was practicing on the piano, then when the piano stopped and my mom would have an opportunity to put on her Ray Charles records and get her groove on. So I grew up kind of very balanced, you know what I mean? Music was really big in my family. Extended family included my father's cousin, whose name was Wynton Kelly.
Yes.
And Wynton Kelly actually played with Miles Davis in late 50s. He's actually on that Kind of Blue album, which is probably the most famous jazz album of all time.
Freddie the Freeloader? Which tune was that?
Exactly. It's Freddie Freeloader.
Yeah. He died way too young.
We met Freddie Freeloader, man, standing in front of the Vanguard, me and my buddies one day in the late 70s. Hey, man, you know who I am? I said, who are you? I'm Freddie Freeloader. I said, wait. I called my buddy, though. I said, hey, man, this is Freddie the Freeloader over here. And he goes, no, not Freddie the Freeloader. Freddie Freeloader. And I'm still, to this day, trying to figure out, what is the difference? Why was he so insistent? Anyway, yeah, Wynton was in the family. All my aunts sang. My dad played the piano, like I said. His dad, you know, my grandfather played the piano as well. So music was always there.
Yeah.
You know, I took a couple of kind of basic lessons from my dad when I was very young on the piano. Started the clarinet at the age of 10. But soon after that, like you said, I heard like Michael Jackson and his brothers, man, and I got really excited. And because I already had a pretty solid musical foundation, I really got extra excited because I thought maybe this is something I could do as well.
What drew you to the clarinet, Marcus?
In the New York public schools in Jamaica, Queens, New York, they offered three instruments, trumpet, drums, and clarinet. And, of course, me and everybody else I knew wanted to play the drums. But living in an apartment in Jamaica, Queens, my father was like, maybe no. maybe the clarinet. You know, I had been playing the recorder, which is like a wooden wind instrument, just in fourth grade at the age of 8, you know. And he said, clarinet's similar to the recorder, so maybe you should go there. So I did. I didn't really know much about the clarinet, but I got into it because I loved music. Started playing the saxophone soon after that because the clarinet and the sax are really similar.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was still, like, you know, listening to Jackson 5, and the Jackson 5 were big fans of Sly and the Family Stone, so I got into them and started getting into the funk scene, getting into the R&B and soul music. And the clarinet just wasn't cutting it, man.
Yeah.
Looking for another instrument.
Sly wasn't looking for a clarinet player in the band. Well, I want to trace that with you just a little bit, and wondering how you get from being, you know, interested in becoming a musician at 10 to 11 years old to picking up and studying clarinet, then to doing electric bass sessions and, you know, work in New York with seasoned professionals as a 15-year-old. I mean, could you give me a sense of what your life was like during those intervening years?
I auditioned for the performing arts magnet school in New York called LaGuardia School.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people know it from that movie Fame. I auditioned on clarinet, and so went to that school. So I was getting a pretty solid musical education, but they didn't give any bass guitar lessons. So I stuck with clarinet in school. So I played bass guitar outside of school, but I was making a lot of progress really fast. 13, 14, 15 years old, I was a maniac. You know, I was playing the bass all the time. You know, one of the advantages I had was that I was living in New York. So a lot of kids who are musicians and feel like they have talent, you know, they have to finish high school, finish their education, then move to New York and start making contacts, start meeting people, getting going. You know, that takes a number of years. For me, I was already meeting people. You know, I mean, I already went to like the high school where all the great musicians were going. So I'd meet people like Omar Hakim, who, the drummer who ended up playing with Sting and played with Chic and played with Madonna, meeting all sorts of people. So by the time I was 15, 16 years old, I was already kind of on the scene there in New York and started doing gigs with Lonnie Liston Smith and Bobby Humphrey. These are jazz funk names from the late 70s.
Oh, yeah.
And ended up playing fusion music, you know, with Lenny White, the drummer who had just left Return Forever, which is Chick Corea's really famous fusion group. So I got on the scene, man, and I just felt an affinity for the bass, and there were a lot of opportunities at that time.
Sure. And you've said that Miles Davis, you've mentioned that working with him was a game changer in terms of how you perceived yourself and your abilities as a musician. What did Miles appreciate most about you, Marcus, and your music?
If I had to guess, I would say that he was proud to see, you know, a young kid who was there in New York taking advantage of every opportunity in New York. You know, for example, when I first got in his band, you know, after a couple of weeks, he said to me, "Man, you never asked me how much I'm paying you." And I said, "Oh, it really doesn't matter, Miles." He said, "What do you mean it doesn't matter? He's about to yell at me about not paying attention to business." And I said, "No, man, I got the number one hit on Aretha Franklin right now. I got the number two hit with Luther Vandross on the charts. And, you know, I do sessions, man, all day long. So I'm making money. And, you know, I really feel like playing with you is such an important opportunity, man, that I actually should be paying you. So whatever you pay me will be cool." And he was like, "Wait a minute, you got the number one song on Aretha Franklin?" I said, "Yeah, Luther Vandross and I wrote it." He's like, "Write me something like that." "Man, I can't write you no R&B, you know what I mean? People would be really upset that Miles decided to go R&B. But he was smiling, you know what I mean? He was laughing, and I could tell that he was proud. He would introduce me to his friends and tell them you know, list my accomplishments. You know what I mean? But I think he really enjoyed seeing somebody who was young, but was expansive and was taking advantage of everything.
In what ways does that sort of approbation from a man like Miles Davis, how did that free you up artistically, say?
Well, it frees you up because if Miles says he likes what you're doing, it doesn't really matter what anybody else thinks anymore.
Mm.
I mean, besides yourself, you know what I mean? Just do your thing, man. I must be on the right path because, you know, Miles is, you know, he's appreciating what I'm doing. So it was, that'll free you. That's the most freeing thing I can imagine. You know what I mean? Somebody that you really respect giving you their blessing, and you're free to just go do your thing.
I get it. Well, what was it like then, not just working, though, with Miles, but taking a leadership role conceptually, compositionally, and as a producer on, say, the album Tutu?
Well, we were, I was in his band, you know, for a couple of years in the early 80s. And then I told him I wanted to leave the band. He's like, why are you leaving? I said, I want to develop as a composer, as a producer, you know, and I think I need to really focus on that because I want to grow, not just as a bass player, but as a complete musician. So he actually gave me his blessing, you know, and told me, you know, look, if you need me, let me know. So, which is really nice. I wasn't expecting that kind of reaction to me telling him that I was leaving the band. But anyway, I went and did my thing. I was working in the studio producing Luther and David Sanborn and Chaka Khan, all sorts of folks. And then I heard a couple of years later that Miles was moving record labels. Along with moving record labels, he wanted to change his musical style. He wanted to do something different, something contemporary. So I called up Warner Brothers and I said, hey, man, you know, I knew a guy named Tommy LaPuma there who was one of the head A&R guys and was going to be working with Miles at this new record label, Warner Brothers. And I said, is it true that Miles is over there at Warner Brothers? And he said, yeah, man, and Miles is looking to do something different. If you have anything that we should hear, let us know. So I went to the studio, man, in my little demo studio and came up with Tutu and a couple of other songs. They had told me that they were working with a number of producers, so I was just hoping that maybe I could get a song or two in there. So I went back out to L.A. and presented Tommy with the music, and he really liked it and said, let's get started. I said, get started what, recording it? He said, yeah. I said, well, Miles hasn't heard. He said, don't worry, Miles will love it. So I started recording, man. I said, where's the band? He said, we're not going to use the band. I want this thing to sound exactly like it sounds on your demo. And I said, well, I played everything myself on the demo. He said, well, then get all your instruments here to the studio. And so I said, whoa, this is really going to be different.
You know? Wow.
So I got all my instruments to the studio and began to build Tutu, you know, instrument by instrument like I had done at my house in the studio. After a few days, Miles came in and heard it. You know, was really really into it. He said, keep going, man. Let me know when you need trumpet. Let me know when you need me. A couple of days after that, I did call him. And that was the toughest part, just giving Miles Davis direction.
That's what I'm wondering about.
Intimidating, you know, because he was my boss for years, and now, you know, he's sitting there at the microphone, and I'm standing there next to him, and he's playing a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It's not quite what I was hoping. And then finally, he just stopped, pulled the trumpet from his mouth, and said, look, man, you got to tell me what you want me to do. I know you know what this stuff is supposed to sound like. I know you know what you want me to do. So stop messing around and tell me. So I made a couple of feeble attempts to instruct him. And when he played what I asked, it sounded so right that then the music took over. And I got so excited about the music, I forgot to be intimidated. And I probably got a little carried away pointing to him, play now, and then holding my hand, stop, don't play now. I'm not sure that I should have went as far as I did, but I couldn't help it because the music was sounding so good. And I'm looking at Tommy, who was in the control room, Tommy LaPuma, and he's like, give me the thumbs up, like, this sounds great. And so that was the first, experience I had with directing him. I got very, very comfortable. We developed a really cool relationship in that respect where, you know, we would sit at the mic together and I'd write out music for him. And what was really cool is in between the takes, in between, you know, when we would record stuff, he would be telling me stories about 1940s, when he was, you know, 19, 20 years old, just meeting Charlie Parker, meeting Dizzy Gillespie, what people were wearing, you know, what people were doing. He was talking about Charlie Parker leaving him on the stage for 22 choruses while Bird went downstairs to do whatever he was doing downstairs, you know.
Yeah.
And Miles was like, man, you know, after like the 15th chorus, I didn't care what I played. This is his band. You know, I'm just making him sound bad.
There's a learning experience.
It was a really amazing experience to be there working with Miles side by side, and hearing these stories and learning about things that, you know, that stayed in his memory, you know, things that were important to him.
I can't imagine. What an education in itself. You know, the soundscapes you create with Tutu and then later with the Mandola, all these, it just floored me when I first heard that. It reminded me, I mean, just thinking about it this afternoon, it's like a modern-day Duke Ellington texture. You know, you just create all these amazing sounds, and that was a big step in terms of getting your unique voice together as a composer. And I was wondering, and you've also got this amazing voice as a bass player and your own bass clarinet sound. In your compositional style, all those things, where did some of the biggest steps forward finding that voice happen? And were there other artists that helped you, you know, help steer you along that way? Or was that all your own, you know, investigation?
The first big step was with David Sanborn. I remember at 21, man, I had some buddies in Jamaica, Queens who were already making their own albums. Tom Brown, incredible trumpeter. Bernard Wright, he had a big record out. So I was thinking, man, maybe I should make my own album. I think I was 21 years old. And I played the four songs that I started on to write. I played a demo of them for David Sanborn. And Sanborn said, I love these tunes. I want to record them. And I said, which one? He said, all of them. I said, you're taking my whole album? And he said, well, you know, you decide. And I eventually decided that making my own album wasn't the right step for me at that point in my development. I might be better off enjoying the sideman thing and just enjoying composing for other people. So,
was that Backstreet? Which album was that?
It's called Voyeur.
Oh, Voyeur, yeah.
It was the one before Backstreet.
That's a good one.
Oh, yeah. And so David really encouraged me. He gave me a lot of freedom in the studio to write for him. I think we really developed a good relationship where I had the sound of his horn in my head and could write stuff that really showcased his ability to play a melody, his ability to play the blues, you know. So that was a big step. And then, of course, with Miles, when I began writing for him, he wasn't giving me a lot of direction, but I didn't need it because I was so inspired by the fact that once I finish writing this song, the lead voice is going to be one of the most incredible lead voices in all instrumental history. You know, Miles Davis's trumpet, you know what I mean? So
sure.
I was like, man, I got to write something good for this guy, you know? And also, I knew that I can't write something that's been done before because that wouldn't be appropriate for Miles. So that really pushed me to find different harmonies, you know, take some things that I really love from the past, like Duke Ellington, who you mentioned, Herbie Hancock, Gil Evans, see if I can incorporate some of those elements into this new sound that I was looking for. So Miles was really important. And then on the R&B side, Luther and I were writing a lot of music, Luther Vandross.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we wrote a song called Jump to It for Aretha Franklin, which brought her back. She had been in like a semi-retirement situation, like 1983. And we came up with that tune, and that really got her started on the next leg of her career. So we're pretty proud of that. But from that point, we began to write a lot of it. I can't talk to you now, girl. I got love to get. My baby calls, I gotta jump to it. I'm in a hurry, there's love to get. When my baby calls, I jump to it. Jump to it.
Getting from composition into your playing, your voice, your unique voice as an instrumentalist, one of the things I've always enjoyed about your bass playing is your shifts from just a groove playing to more melodic accompaniment and then being the soloist out front. And those transitions always seem so smooth when you're up there on stage or in the studio. Could you share some of the decisions that you make in performance that guide you in those moments?
You know, I grew up with a couple of different mentalities coming from a neighborhood where I came from, which was R&B and soul. The bass player's job was to hold the band together. If you were playing all this fancy stuff, but you weren't holding the band together, it had no effect at all. Matter of fact, you'd probably lose your job because nobody was interested in anything that didn't just groove, just make people continue to dance. We're talking about like the mid-70s, where if you listen to those recordings, the bass is a lot of times louder on the recordings than the drums. You know, the bass was the instrument that that was holding the whole thing together. If you listen to those Motown records, you know, James Jamerson is just, he's the rhythmic heart of that music. So that was your job as a bass player in the culture that I was growing up. Then eventually I discovered Stanley Clarke and Jaco Pastorius, musicians like that who really inspired me to develop the upper register, develop my technique, develop my improvisational skills. And so I kind of grew up on two tracks at the same time. So if you were to hear me in concert, when the band is playing and it's not my turn to solo, my job is to really hold it down. I'm not trying to impress anybody except with how good the music feels. And then if somebody says, hey, time for the bass solo, then it was time for me to wreak some havoc. You know what I mean? So it was cool. You know, Sinbad the comedian,
yeah.
We were just talking the other day, and he said, man, I can't believe how you do it, man. You play all that nice, tasty stuff, and then you just go off. And I it was funny, but I understood what he was saying. You know, I really have no interest when I'm playing behind Whitney Houston or Mariah Carey. I have no interest in drawing people's attention to me, to the bass, unless, you know, they're just focused on how good it feels. I was a studio musician for like 25 years.
Yeah.
Which, and as a studio musician, that's the same mentality. Just make the music sound good. Make it feel good. That's what I was doing during the day. And then at night when I'm playing in the clubs, you know what I mean? And Jaco comes to sit in with us, you know what I mean? We would go at it. And I really felt like to be a complete musician, you had to be able to do both.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. We'll have more of David Ford's conversation with Marcus Miller right after this break, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Let's get back to David Ford's conversation with Marcus Miller. The Grammy-winning producer and bassist is playing at the 5th Annual John Coltrane International Jazz and Blues Festival in High Point, North Carolina, on Saturday, September 5th.
I'm curious about something that might surprise even your most ardent fan out there. What's something about Marcus Miller that might surprise even your most knowledgeable fans out there?
Well, I just decided a few years ago to learn French. Was wondering if I could do it starting in my 40s. And it became a really cool hobby because, you know, we do a lot of concerts. We probably do 30 or 40 concerts in French-speaking countries a year. So I thought it might be nice to do it. And I'm at the point now where, you know, I have my own radio show on the French radio station, the French jazz station out of Paris for a couple of years that I was doing all in French. That was pretty cool. You know, I like to find challenges and see things that maybe I can develop and see if it's possible, you know, just get through. But I got into it, and then, you know, with my latest album, Aphrodisia, it's crazy because I decided I wanted to collaborate with some musicians from West Africa. I wanted to follow the slave route and collaborate with musicians from different styles along the slave route. I'm the spokesperson for UNESCO's Slave Route Project, and they just want to raise awareness of the history of the Atlantic slave trade, make sure people know, particularly young people, make sure they know the story. And to celebrate the fact that people got through slavery, you know, that at least in the U.S. it doesn't exist anymore in that form. So I decided I wanted to follow the slave route just to kind of acknowledge this thing. And I thought it would create some interesting music. So I decided I wanted to collaborate with some musicians from North Africa, from West Africa. And the ability to speak French ended up coming in really handy because I could communicate with the African cats. I could communicate with the Moroccan cats.
Well, I want to talk with you about this fantastic new album, Aphrodisia. Could you flesh out a little bit your work as a UNESCO artist for peace, Marcus, and its impact on this recording project?
UNESCO, from time to time, they appoint as an artist for peace. Herbie Hancock was appointed a few years ago, and he asked me to come to the ceremony in Paris. Herbie and I just finished a tour, a tribute to Miles' tour, and he said, come to Paris, you know, I'm going to get appointed an artist for peace. And basically what they do is they say, you know what, you're an artist for peace, so just go forth and make sure you communicate with as many diverse cultures as possible, because communication is the first step towards peace, and musicians have a unique ability to communicate with people because we don't have to rely just on words. You know, we can go in front of an audience where we don't speak the language and still make a connection. It's really important to make these kind of connections, especially these days. Herbie, his first act as an artist for peace was to create the International Day of Jazz, where on its 5th year, going into its 5th year, every year on April 30th, every country in the world celebrates jazz on the same day. You know, they do something, whether it's a concert or a symposium on jazz, whatever it is, they acknowledge jazz. And I'm talking about everywhere, Iraq and the Central African Republic, all over the place. They celebrate jazz, and there's a big main concert in a big city. Next year it's going to be in Washington, D.C., actually, but it's been in Paris, it's been in Istanbul, Turkey, it's been in Osaka, Japan. So, very cool thing. That's the first thing that Herbie did. A couple of years later, I was performing a concert in France, and I performed a song called Gore from my previous album, Renaissance. And Gore tells the story of my visit to the island of Gore, which is off the coast of Senegal. This is where they used to stockpile Africans in these slave houses before they would send them off into slavery. It's really emotional to visit this place and see the small rooms that they stockpile them in. They put them in there, one on top of the other. So anyway, I wrote this song about what I was experiencing standing there. And the people from UNESCO were in the audience, and they came up to me. I'd met them with Herbie. They came up to me after the show and said, guess what, you're next. We want you to be an artist for peace, and we have a special project called Slavery Project that we'd like you to be the spokesperson for, to help us bring awareness to this project and to the history of slavery. So that's basically how it went down.
And the Slave Root Project, I know you've shared this story in concert and with audiences, but could you just relate to our audience what it was like being at Gore Island in person and visiting the museum there that called the Slave House?
We had a concert in Senegal. This was probably 5 or 6 years ago now. It was a festival, an arts festival, and the day before the concert, they asked us if we'd be interested in taking a small boat ride, 10, 15 minutes off the coast of Senegal to this Gore Island. And, you know, I had heard about Gore. Lots of people visit Gore because of this museum they have on the island called the Slave House. In fact, President Obama had been there maybe 2 weeks before we were there. So you walk through the island and you arrive at the Slave House, and it's a little place, and it has these rooms. And then the guide begins to talk, and he says, you know, they would capture Africans from, you know, the interior of Africa and bring them, and they would keep them here as holding cells. They would take inventory. They would check them out health-wise to make sure they were healthy enough to endure the eventual boat ride, you know, across the Atlantic. And he said, this room was for men, this one was for women, this was for children. And they would just stack them in there, one on top of the other, and keep them there for about 3 months. And then eventually they would walk them through this door of the Slave House. And this door was called, actually, the Door of No Return. If you look through the door, you could see the ocean. That's all you could see. They'd march them through the door and put them on the big boats and send them away. So that door was hugely symbolic because it basically represented the end of the life as these Africans knew it and the beginning of this experience, this slave experience.
Your song, Gore, on the Renaissance CD was obviously inspired by that experience, but standing at the door of no return, and yet you take that moment in the latter part of that, in an inspiring direction through your music, and you've said that Aphrodisia essentially picks up the baton there and runs with it forward.
Yeah, the main message I was trying to convey with the song Gore was, yeah, this thing was horrible, and we've been talking about how horrible it was for many years, but it's also something maybe we should celebrate. We should celebrate the fact that we came through it, that slavery doesn't exist in that form anymore. And also the music, because these Africans, when they got to, you know, America, the Caribbean, South America, they weren't allowed to read, they weren't allowed to write. And you know, how do you hold on to your history? You know, how do you tell people about, you know, your family, your history? And they did it through music. Music was really the salvation, you know. Slaves working in the fields, they sang. You know, they couldn't sing about how messed up their life was because the overseers were there checking them. So they sang something else. But they kept the message in there. The message was still in there. If you listen to the melodies, you could hear the sorrow you could hear the pain, but you could also hear the resilience. And then, you know, those songs that they sang in the fields, they became spirituals. You know, spirituals, you know, became gospel. You know, we ended up with, in New Orleans, we ended up with jazz that kind of evolved from this whole experience. Jazz, you know, gave birth to the blues to begin with, rhythm and blues, R&B, funk music, rock music, you know, hip-hop, all these styles of music that we're known for here in America and around the world. They're all results of the experience, of the slave experience. It wouldn't exist without it. So this music that we created out of all this pain is just a testament to the resilience of people, man, and how people can transform horrible situations into something positive.
When you bring it all out in this album, I love the blending of sounds here, and the High Life is just a great example right off the bat. The opening groove, it's just this perfect blending of upbeat funk and Ghanaian and Senegalese percussive and vocal styles. How do you maintain that balance with the modern and the African instrumentalists, these great vocalists, without sounding derivative, for lack of a better way? It just sounds organic. It sounds like Marcus is in Africa.
Well, that's what it was, man. And it was, I really didn't want to try to make it sound like I was trying to do authentic music from Ghana, because I'm not from there. I thought it'd be more honest to say, hey, I really appreciate and love this culture, and I would really like to mix it and see if we can find a way to make it work together. And it was simply me sitting down with the guitar player, you know, from Mali, for example, just face-to-face, you know, and just playing for each other, you know what I mean? And he's watching my fingers, and I'm watching his fingers, man, and we're starting to imitate each other, and all of a sudden, we got something going on this night.
What sorts of rhythms and sounds or qualities do you admire most in some of the African musicians on Aphrodisia? I mean, I love the, like, the delicate quality of the male vocal on this track, Alun Wad. I mean, there's so many.
Yeah, Alun, he's a great musician, and he was basically my connection to the African musicians who are on the album. In fact, you know, people ask me, how did this Aphrodisia album get started? I said, in Poland. People are like, wait.
Of course.
Aphrodisia started in Poland, but I was doing a festival, a music festival in Poland, and Alun Wad was in another band. And he came to me and introduced himself to me. He said, hey, I'm from Senegal. My name is Alun, but they know me in Senegal as Marcus. You know, I'm like the Senegalese Marcus. You know? And then he played me a couple of my licks. You know what I mean? We're laughing. And I said, look, man, I had this idea for a collaborative album, and I want to work with some West Africans. Man, where should I go? You know, which country do you recommend? He said, go to Paris. I said, what do you mean Paris? He said, there's such a huge African community in Paris that you can work with people from Mali, from Senegal, from Burkina Faso, right there without traveling to each country. So that's what we ended up doing, man. And, you know, Alun is a bass player. He's a singer. He has a beautiful voice. The thing I noticed about African musicians is that, you know, with American musicians, when I write a song and we begin to work on the song, I find myself saying, no, that rhythm isn't quite exactly. I want you to adjust the rhythm a little bit. And sometimes some musicians won't understand the subtleties of the difference. I'm playing what you just said. I said, no, it's actually not exactly what I'm asking. You know what I mean? Listen carefully. Listen to where this beat is placed. Stuff like that. With the Africans, that really didn't happen. You know what I mean? The rhythm is such a central element of the music there that they get that right away. That doesn't even have to be talked about.
You know? Yeah.
I had to fix some of the notes sometimes because, you know, they weren't necessarily jazz players, some of the guys. You know what I mean? I'm like, dude, you can't keep playing that same note through these chords, man. It's clashing, you know what I mean? So he said, oh, really? It sounds good to me. I said, well, I said, look, when I hold up my hand, just stop playing for one bar and let us get that fancy chord out of the way, and then you start again, you know what I mean? So we did stuff like that. But the idea that the rhythm is so, so much information, and the rhythm was really an aspect of these African musicians that I thought was impressive. And then how important melodies are. Singing melodies and the words aren't really that important. I think that that's really an aspect of music that people need to know about. You know, people hear R&B music or they hear a certain kind of dance music and they say, oh, the words are so ridiculous, you know what I mean? And it's the same thing over and over again. I said, because the information is not in the words. The information is in the melody and the rhythm, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you have to learn to listen to it like that. That's an aspect of African music that I think is different from American music. Sa'aduna Danko
I was reading what you wrote about each song on Aphrodisia on your website, and I just about broke down reading about Preacher's Kid, song for William H. And it's a song for your father and a tribute to the really huge role he's played in your life, as you put it, as a musician and as a man. How so? Tell me about it.
Well, my dad, born in Brooklyn, you know, his dad was from Trinidad, and he was a minister. And my dad was a preacher's kid. We call him PK. And there's specific like experiences that preacher's kids have. You know, they have to actually be an example in the community. You know, a lot of pressure, you know, because your father's a minister. You know what I mean? And so my dad grew up that way, really valued education and was really dedicated to music. He played the organ, played the piano, and had dreams of being a professional. But then, you know, his first kid arrived, which was me, and then they had another kid, my younger brother. And so he had to make a decision, and he ended up driving the bus in Brooklyn, and then he drove the F train for a while. And I saw him never stop his growth. You know, I saw him take night classes at Brooklyn College to get his degree that he never managed to get when he was younger. I saw him practicing his music and performing at church every Sunday, and not just dialing it in, you know what I mean? Just really, you know, putting on concerts after the service, you know what I mean? Really presenting people with rich music. And so he's very inspiring, you know what I mean? Work ethic, crazy work ethic, you know, and just a really, really incredible human being. My mom also, I don't want to leave her out, you know what I mean? But as a musician, you know, he was very serious. And so I saw early on what it takes to be a musician. I think I absorbed a lot of that.
Yeah.
So with Preacher's Kid, you know, I was like, you know, I would really like to write something for Dad. In September, he's going to be 90 years old.
Wow.
And thought, you know, and he's got Alzheimer's, you know what I mean? So I'm just thankful that he still recognized me. He knows who I am. You know, he's smiling when I walk in the door. So I wanted to walk in the door with a piece of music. That's really what I wanted to do. So,
what was his reaction to the tune when he first heard it?
You know, I played it for him, and I just talked him through the whole tune. I said, okay, first it's going to start with choir, Dad. You know, I know you love the choir. He's like, oh, yeah. And I said, you're not going to understand what they're singing, because they're singing in an African language from Senegal. You know, but this is what they're saying. They're saying you dedicated your life to service of the Lord, and you will be rewarded. Okay, so he's smiling, he's listening. And I said, okay, that's the melody. That's the basic melody. Now you're going to hear the same melody, Dad, in the jazz version, you know, with my bass clarinet. Of course, he recognizes the clarinet because he used to accompany me when I was practicing my Mozart stuff. He played the piano part and I played the clarinet. So he's smiling there. And then I said, the chords are going to be a little weird, because he's always commenting on the weird harmonies that we use in jazz, you know. But, you know, we jazzed it up, but you're gonna understand it. And so I took him through the whole thing, man. And then I said, finally, here's an organ solo, okay, by a guy named Corey Henry, who's 21 years old, that guy. Incredible on the organ, and I had to have an organ in there because that's what you've been doing all these years. So it's beautiful to see him smile and see him absorb the music, you know. And I wish everybody could do that to their parents, you know, just give them a gift of something that really touches them, because it's you can't describe it.
Well, Marcus Miller, thank you so much for, man, taking time out to talk with me about this great album and your life, and I just really appreciate it so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, man.
Marcus Miller. His latest album is called Aphrodisia, and we've been sampling from it throughout the show. He's playing at the 5th Annual John Coltrane International Jazz and Blues Festival in High Point, North Carolina on Saturday, September 5th. Other highlights of the weekend include Snarky Puppy, Earl Clue, Pancho Sanchez, and David Sanborn. You can hear David Ford's interview with David Sanborn and find out more details on the festival at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. We have to take one more short break, and when we return, it's this week's Triad To Do, and a conversation with singer-songwriter Beth McKee.
Well, it's a long road back, Highway 49. And there's a whole lot of miles lying ahead and behind. I'm on my way, and I'm running out of time.
When Triad Arts Weekend continues.
Get back home. I wonder who I'll see. Won't be no yellow ribbon tied around no tree. Nobody's gonna be there waiting for me.
Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. In just about 5 minutes from now, we have your weekly to-do list all filled out for you. But first, David Ford takes us to Sika for a musical conversation.
Singer-songwriter Beth McKee's Sugarcane Revival and Hurricane Party with Tommy Malone and Jeffrey Dean Foster comes to the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, Sika, next weekend. Indie Week says Beth's music, quote, sits at the edge of the swamp and the city, adding cosmopolitan polish to the regional impulses of the places she's called home. We're sampling from Beth's new CD, Sugarcane Revival.
Well, I think that New Orleans throughout history has shown a great resilience, and that's kind of what we want to celebrate at our event. There's been a lot of growth and renewal. The culture certainly has taken a hit because of some of the people that have not been able to return. But I see new culture coming in and, you know, filling the gaps, and young people coming up with new energy. But I feel good about New Orleans. I've been very happy and proud to have ever been associated with the city, and I still feel like it's a second home. And I still feel like more art and great music is coming out of there every day, and that's important to me. So the ethos of New Orleans is intact.
There's that gentrification part of the equation that does change a place.
Right. You know, I guess that happens with a lot of places. But I also know that New Orleans and New Orleans culture is a little bit like what I think of in Florida with development, in that, yeah, it's going to come along. They're going to build a bunch of stuff. But if you leave it alone for 5 minutes, it's going to return to just like it was before the developers came.
That old kudzu is going to grow back.
Yes. The palmettos will once again thrive. Yeah. So I feel the same way about New Orleans culture and the vibe there. It's going to always have that special element.
I was brought up happy.
You're going to give us a little taste of that right here in lovely, lively Winston-Salem, North Carolina, coming up for this revival and hurricane party. What's it going to be like there at Sika?
And it's a wonderful venue. It's going to start out with a songwriter in the round set with my friends Tommy Malone from the Subdudes and Jeffrey Dean Foster, who is a wonderful songwriter here in Winston-Salem. So I'm very excited about that element right there. That would be enough for a whole night.
You know? Fill our listeners in on a typical songwriter session.
Well, a songwriter in the round will set up sort of in a semicircle, and we'll each play a song. We'll take turns playing our songs, and we'll talk a little bit about the process of writing songs or what's been going on in our lives. Whatever's relevant in the moment, it's kind of a casual thing. And it gives the audience sort of a inside look at the process. There's going to be lots of New Orleans-centric food and beverages that will be available. Maybe
nice.
Boudin, maybe some gumbo.
Get all hungry.
Kinds of, yeah.
Just thinking about it.
I know, me too. And beignets.
You got to have beignets.
Yeah, you got to have beignets so everybody can come back in with white powder all over their faces. And the second set will commence with myself and my band performing some songs from Sugar Cane Revival, my new CD.
Gotta shed a light on.
And we'll segue into the Hurricane Party, which will be a New Orleans-centric sort of last waltz. Like the band did the last waltz, we're going to have a coordinated jam session. So I'm working with Tommy and with Jeffrey Dean Foster to pull together just the right songs for us. So we're going to be kind of create our own little band there.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm very excited about it. We've already getting some really great ideas for song selection to celebrate the resilience and the revival and the determination of the New Orleans community.
Singer-songwriter Beth McKee. We've been sampling from her new album, Sugar Cane Revival, and you can hear her perform several selections live at SICA on Saturday, August 29th in Winston-Salem. Beth McKee's Sugar Cane Revival and Hurricane Party with Tommy Malone and Jeffrey Dean Foster kicks off at 7 o'clock, and you'll find links to more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Welcome to Try It To Do. I'm Eddie Garcia, here with Bethany Chafin.
Hello.
Hello, and Neil Chernoff, our Morning Edition host.
Hey there.
So what do you have for us today, Neil?
Well, I have to tell you, Eddie and Bethany, I'm one of those people that's fairly a new convert to bluegrass. I'm one of those guys...
To new grass,
and I'm one of those people who used to make, like, banjo jokes and everything. I would like to tell you about the band that actually changed my mind about bluegrass. That's the Steep Canyon Rangers. And I'm sure they are familiar to most people in the WFDD listening audience. They're homegrown, a band that started in 2000 at UNC Chapel Hill. They now have about 9 albums. As a matter of fact, their 9th studio album called Radio is coming out basically as we speak. And they're going to be performing this Saturday at the Blue Ridge Music Center in Galax. I'm really looking forward to it. I missed their concert there last year when I had just moved here. And in that time, I've become such a big fan of them, particularly with their work with Steve Martin. Mm-hmm. They went on tour with Steve Martin and Edie Brickell. These guys are just fantastic. And the opening band is going to be the Mountain Park Old Time Band. So for me, this is the first time I'll be seeing the Steep Canyon Rangers live. WFDD will be there. Plus, my first time at the Blue Ridge Music Center. So I'm quite excited about the Steep Canyon Rangers, the Blue Ridge Music Center in Galax. That's Saturday, August 29th at 7 p.m.
Great.
All right, Bethany, what do you have?
You know, a lot of the schools have gone back in the past few weeks, and so I think some people are sad because they're feeling summer's coming to an end. But there's one series that is continuing on for a couple more weeks, so you can hold on to those last days of summer. It is the Cinema Under the Stars event at Rinalda House. They're going for 2 more weeks, like I said. This Friday, they're going to be showing Dr. Strangelove, Stanley Kubrick's famous film. And then on September 4th, Rushmore is going to be playing. So gates open at 7:30. The movie usually starts around 8:30. In case it rains, you can still watch your film. They'll be going inside the museum. And so it's a great way to stay outside these last few weeks of summer and enjoy a film under the stars.
So there'll be food or beverages available at the screening?
I do know about beverages. Wine and beer are available.
Excellent.
So last but not least, Eddie, what do you have?
Well, I'd like to talk about a documentary that's currently playing at Aperture Cinema. It's called Best of Enemies, and it's about the debates between William F. Buckley Jr. and Gore Vidal during the Republican and Democratic National Convention in 1968. And this was something I had never heard about.
you know, they say it was 10 debates that changed television and the media landscape forever. And when you see the documentary, you see that that's pretty true, because these guys were on the extreme ends of conservatism and liberalism. William F. Buckley Jr., you know, he was the founder of the National Review. Gore Vidal was known for his liberal-leaning novels. They both had political aspirations at one point in their life, but they became kind of the forefathers of the modern punditry scene, really. NBC and CBS were tied for first with news. And this is, you have to remember, there were three channels, right? Mm-hmm. And this is where America got their news. But ABC was always in third. And some people said if they could have been fourth, they would have been fourth place. But they came up with this idea to have these live debates after every convention. And from night one, they swept the ratings.
And these guys really did not like each other.
They did not like each other. They each really felt that the other was a threat to America, to the fabric of our country. Although it did launch and inspire lots of the type of punditry that is obnoxious in today's modern media landscape. I mean, after they did this, then you started seeing the whole point-counterpoint mm-hmm. thing kind of blossom. These guys are both, for however you may agree or disagree with them, a level of intellectualism and a wealth of vocabulary that you don't see on the scene today. So I definitely would recommend it to those that are interested in media, politics, or just to kind of see how far we've come and how things have mm-hmm. changed.
So, by the way, if you drop a banjo and an accordion off the Empire State Building at the same time, which one lands first?
I don't know which one.
I have no idea.
Who cares?
And that's trying to do. Triad Arts Weekend's executive producer is David Ford. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our contributing editor is Kike Rodriguez-Pastor. You'll find podcasts, archived episodes, and links to our guests, events, videos, and more on our website, wfdd.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can follow us on Twitter as well. Our handle is Triad Arts Speak. And be sure to like WFDD on Facebook. Triad Arts Weekend is a production of 88.5 WFDD, public radio for the Piedmont. I'm Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.